Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Requiem Radio. You have myself, your host, Swilly Requiem, and my co-host and partner, Hazy Dialix. And with us today, we have our special guest, Tweetaphon. Tweetaphon recently released his new book, Elia, and it is about branching novel that focuses on heavily on metaphysics and morality. He wanted to write it as clear as accessible as he can for people as possible, and I hope you find something of value within its pages. We'll be including the link of that after. He also has a great enjoyment for the pre-Socratics, or in particular for Parmenides. So we'll be touching a lot on classic philosophy as well in this conversation. Hazy, do you want to do a quick introduction of yourself?
Yes, I'm Hazy Dialix. As you know, I am the co-host of this channel. I usually help out with the podcast, you know, discussing many of the topics and often bounce off ideas with some of our great guests as the ones we have on today. He'll be discussing the book and really telling us about the substance of it to really, you know, get into it. So I'm ready to get into it, and we can start discussing that.
Sure. And Tweetaphon, the man of the hour, would you like to introduce yourself?
Thank you for the welcome, Sola. It's great to be on here. In terms of my interest in the ancients, yes, I'm a big fan of ancient Greek and ancient Chinese philosophy and history. I don't work in the field. I'm not a professor at a university or an archaeologist or anything of that nature. By trade, I'm an attorney, but it's always been my hobby for at least the last almost 30 years, I guess maybe 25 years now, just reading the classics in my spare time. And then once you get through all the major texts, you know, you kind of sift through fragments that you can find, and it's just fascinating stuff. And I particularly like Parmenides and the other Eleatic philosophers. So I'm very happy to be here to chat with you about them. Thank you.
Thank you. And what got you interested in philosophy as a whole? And then more specifically, what got you interested into the Greeks, the ancients?
Yeah, you know, I don't want to say it's something, well, maybe it is just something natural to people that we wind up getting drawn into philosophy. I mean, don't students, or boys at least, argue about politics and what's right and wrong and what we ought to do and whether taxes should go up or down or whatnot? And invariably, when you start bickering or arguing about those things, you form your opinions and you try to justify them, and you wind up getting a general idea of how things ought to be and how everything hangs together. And when you're trying to justify it and discussing it with others, you find people organize themselves into different schools. You know, I'm a Platonist, or I'm an Aristotelian, or I'm with the Germans, I'm a Nietzschean, or something like that. Or I'm a Christian, you know, maybe they follow the teachings of the church, and it informs their ideas of how things ought to be. And so I think we all get drawn into philosophy and into this desire to explain how our ideas hang together and why people ought to follow them and what ideas we ought to arrive on. The Greeks in particular, you know, it's kind of odd. You know, I didn't grow up in the church, and I don't have a strong personal interest in Abrahamic religions. So that was never really on my radar growing up. But I did have, you know, I think around in my late teens or mid-teens, I decided one day I'm going to read grown-up books. And so the grown-up book I found was Machiavelli, The Prince. And I read that. And, you know, I was in my mid-teens or so. But he references a lot of ancient Greek history. And so after Machiavelli, I wound up getting a copy of Herodotus. And I think it just wound up going from there, honestly. And then when I did go to college, you know, we have our 101 intro to Western Civ stuff. And again, you wind up reading Plato and the like. But I was also introduced to some Chinese works at that time. And I just, for a while there, and also when I was younger, I had learned some Chinese language, and I had an interest in China already. And so I wound up diving into that stuff as well. And I just kind of fixated on the ancient Greek and ancient Chinese stuff. I mean, I read a little Roman stuff, Latin, but yeah, just, I guess that's how I got started, and I just fixated on it. And here I am now, still talking about it.
And to go a bit deeper with the question, a lot of people who do show interest in the ancients usually circulate around three figures, and that is Socrates, Plato, or Aristotle. But you have a more unique approach where you chose Parmenides as some of the people you would arguably say you agree with a lot, or you enjoy a lot of his views and philosophy. What do you think makes Parmenides stand out compared to the others? And what in particular caught your interest from him? And then you were interested in him first compared to, like, let's say Aristotle or the other guys.
Yeah, if I could take the two questions, we'll start with the second one and then go to the first one. It's not that I didn't like Plato or didn't like Aristotle. There were times when I, you know, would have disagreements with them or times when I would agree with them. But I think with anyone who takes up reading the classics as a hobby and just dives in and reads so many different works and starts gathering up all these good ideas and saying, yeah, I think that makes sense. Yeah, I think that makes sense. This guy over here said the right thing. That guy over there said the right thing. At some point, you gather up all these ideas and then you realize, oh, some of them are not consistent with each other. And at that point, I think I reached a point where I had a bunch of ideas from Plato, Aristotle, Parmenides, and others. And I realized they weren't all hanging together so well. And so I had to go back and re-examine them. Why Parmenides in particular? When you have all these ideas and you want to see how they hang together, you need a very broad thinker, someone who really wants to cast the net as wide as possible and say, here is the context of all that you're saying. And Parmenides is really the one who touches on that, right? He's sometimes said to be the father of metaphysics or the start of Western metaphysics. And we all know the famous line where we say Western philosophy is a series of footnotes to Plato or whatnot. I mean, if you guys pick up the Phoenix pre-Socratics version of Parmenides of Alea, the fragments, the professor there says, you know, Plato's kind of a series of footnotes to Parmenides. Parmenides is really there at the beginning of Western metaphysics, and laying out the broadest possible context and showing in the broadest terms how everything must hang together and be consistent with each other. And when I realized that he was the broadest, like he was speaking at the broadest possible level, and then I went down and I started considering all these other ideas I had, I found that there were just some fundamental issues that weren't adding up, and I wound up just agreeing with Parmenides at common ideas of change and motion and gradation in existence. And many of these common things that are spoken of are just not coherent, or they just don't make any sense when you actually examine them. And so I wound up having to go back and say, okay, actually, I still kind of like some of the stuff Plato said. I still kind of appreciate a lot of the stuff Aristotle and others said. But I can't just follow them to the hilt. I have to back off a bit and say, nah, you guys did not have the breadth of thought of Parmenides. And as a result, you fall into some contradictions or there's some unexplained things that just don't work. And so I wound up picking Parmenides and of course, the other Eleatics like Melissus and Zeno and going from there. So that's specifically why I just thought this is the guy who has the broadest possible observation. And he's the guy who's saying, whatever else you have to say, it has to be consistent with that framework or with that broad context. And once you realize that, you have to be consistent, and there's the broadest context. It's kind of a vicious process of cutting down arguments from all the people that are usually beloved, like Plato and Aristotle. And you mentioned Socrates. Obviously, people love him. He's more of a character in the dialogues of Plato and Xenophon, but... Yeah, I just wound up having to cut a lot of what they had to say out. It was just like, nope, sorry guys, you don't have the breadth of thought of Parmenides, and you're not consistent, given that point about everything exists that Parmenides makes.
Would this be getting more in line to Parmenides' rejection of non-being? How he would argue what is not cannot exist, because that would imply a contradiction, so... Correct me if I'm wrong in this, but wouldn't Parmenides argue that non-being is conceptual error and does not correspond to anything real?
That's right. So there's multiple interpretations of Parmenides. I don't know if it'd be valuable to go over how the fragments have been received and what we have, but there are multiple interpretations. I'm of the interpretation you just gave, which is that Parmenides is saying there is what there is, and that's kind of the end of the story. There just is. And if someone says there's something other than what is, it's a direct contradiction, because it's saying that there is not, which by definition is not supposed to be what is. But if there only is what is, then any attempt to go beyond that would be incorrect. Usually my interpretation of Parmenides and the Eleatics, that's how I read them. I read them as saying there's one core teaching, is, or existence, or being, you know, what is. And then all of their subsequent arguments kind of trace back to that fact. For example, like we were just saying, if you just say there is, and that's the broadest observation, and that's the whole of existence, then you can say that existence is solitary. You know, what is solitary. Because there's nothing else, there's nothing next to it, there's nothing beyond it, there just is. What is? So what is becomes solitary.
So please correct me on this then, but the doctrine of being then, that would be the what is, or the unchanging, eternal, or indivisible thing. So true reality, in a sense, would be a single, unchanging, indivisible entity.
Right, right. So that's my reading of Parmenides, that reality is essentially this solitary, unchanging, indivisible or invincible, perfectly complete, because not lacking anything, because there's nothing else to lack. Entity, just as like this one metaphysical entity that contains all meaning, that subsumes all meaning. Ultimately, all these adjectives that we're applying to it, like indivisible, solitary, unchanging, all those adjectives are justified by that initial observation that there just is. You could call that the doctrine of being. When you said true reality, that gets into some, you know, discussions, because if there just is what there is, then it's all true reality, right? There's no other reality. There is what is. There's not like a fake reality beyond what is. But if you have a more dualist interpretation of Parmenides, something you might see from a Neoplatonist, like Simplicius, and of course they're going to say this is the interpretation of Plato as well, you actually have a gradation. So you may have like true reality, this unchanging, indivisible, perfect, whatnot, and then you have a realm of shadows or illusions, the path of seeming. That gets more into the fragments. That's not my reading, but yeah, if we're going to talk about a true reality, I don't believe there's a fake reality. So I never have to say the word true, but some people do that. They'll posit both true and fake realities.
If I may ask, especially for the audience, you've mentioned numerous times already that there's your interpretation. What are the main schools of thoughts that you are aware of, or interpretations of Parmenides? Like, if you could name a few of them, like the main groups.
Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, we just mentioned Simplicius, right? So you have this idea of Parmenides almost as a dualist, because we're speaking specifically about Parmenides. He writes a poem, and it's about a youth being taken by maidens on a chariot to see a goddess. And then the goddess says, I'm going to teach you two things. I'm going to teach you the steadfast heart of persuasive truth, that it is, that there is what is. And then I'm going to tell you about the opinions of mortals. And somehow these opinions have genuine existence. And so you have the three sections of the poem are going to be the proem, which is where he goes to meet the goddess. Then you're going to have the way of truth, and then you're going to have the way of seeming. And so an interpretation from Simplicius might be that the way of truth, everything that is said there, is discussing an unchanging, perfect reality or layer of reality. And then the way of seeming, where we discuss the mortal opinions, is going to be about a lesser realm, or a realm of change, where things really are like shadows or illusions or appearances. And so that's one reading. You also have a very modern reading where they don't think that Parmenides is discussing reality as a whole. They don't think that this is a metaphysical or existential poem. So when I say that, I mean, when most people are reading this poem, at least historically, what they say is he's talking about existence as a whole, reality as a whole. And so what they'll say is actually what he's discussing is not reality as a whole. He's discussing what it means to be a real thing. Like, what is the criteria to be a real thing, or to be a thing? And so then when we say, you know, it has to be complete, it has to be indivisible, it has to be unchanging, etc., their interpretation would be that he's talking about this is the criteria for a given thing to be a real thing. You know, it has to have those attributes to be a real thing. Now, again, that's another interpretation that's different from Simplicius, different from mine. The thing When I said that I drew up that quote from Plato or about Plato where it's, you know, Western philosophy is a series of footnotes to Plato, it's not really that cheeky to say Plato is a series of footnotes to Parmenides in the sense that a lot of ink has been spilt about reading Parmenides in antiquity and today. And so there are a number of other ways of reading the poem than the two and my own. So we've given three so far, but there are others.
I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah, continue. My apologies.
Oh, no worries. I was about to end there. I was just going to say if people are into skeptics, for example, you know, there's a discussion of the skeptics interpreting him their own way. Obviously, you know, a skeptic could read him in a way where this, I mean, the stereotype of an Eleatic is to say that the senses or appearances are not trustworthy, which, you know, in the poem, they do talk about the problems with appearances. But for a skeptic who wants to doubt all of our sense perceptions and ideas, again, they have their own take on Parmenides. So yeah, there's a lot of material out there.
And we discussed Plato, and you were talking about how some philosophers would say that, you know, it's the footnotes to Plato, or vice versa, Plato's the footnotes to Parmenides. But a question I was more curious on that I don't think it's talked enough, but how do you think Parmenides' philosophy compares and contrasts with other pre-Socratic philosophers, such as, let's say, Heraclitus or Anaximander, those individuals? And apologies if I butchered the last name, but I'm curious on your thoughts on that.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you asked that question, because there's one thing I would... Well, I don't advise against. I mean, everyone approaches these texts and they read them, and over the years they get an idea for who all these people are and what they think. A common meme is sort of the Platonic meme of Heraclitus is the flux guy where you can't step in the river twice, and Parmenides is the unmoving, unchanging guy who thinks everything is one, you know, perfectly still blob or something. And so Parmenides and Heraclitus, flux versus stasis, I guess, or static, being completely unchanging. Stasis, not a good word given the Greek, but the he kind of pits them together, like off each other, like they're opposites, and it's kind of almost meme tier. But I don't want to treat pre-Socratics as memes. Heraclitus, even though traditionally someone's going to say, oh, if you like Parmenides, you won't like Heraclitus, because Heraclitus says it's all in flux and Parmenides says it's not in flux. But Heraclitus has plenty of stuff that you can say is valuable and does inform some of Parmenides' thought. It's not clear who was born first. Usually we think Heraclitus is born first, but it's tough dating these people. Heraclitus does talk about opposites being unified, right? There's something that brings them together. They kind of come together. So you can't have hot without cold, and you can't have cold without hot. They kind of presuppose each other, and you can even observe that they have to be on the same scale. So they're in some sense unified. So opposites wind up being unified. There's also Heraclitus has some... I just want to say essentially Heraclitus is a deeper thinker than that meme, and I wouldn't want to suggest that people interpret Parmenides and Heraclitus just as that flux versus staying still meme. Because I think if you look into the discussion of opposites that are in some of Heraclitus's fragments, maybe you'll find some common ground there. The one thing I do find interesting is that, you know, Parmenides, like we were saying, is essentially considered the father of Western metaphysics. He's explicitly talking about being in its broadest sense, as long as we interpret him that way. And he's providing logical arguments, like almost like a formal logical argument. Or some people just say it is. It's like this logical argument put forward in defense of a metaphysical position. And the impact seems to have been pretty big on the people that follow him. Like if you pick up the pre-Socratic Empedocles, Empedocles is, of course, a love and strife guy. He gets the meme as a love and strife guy, where those are the two main forces that power change and the cycle of the universe. But the Empedocles, a lot of his work has actually survived in lengthy fragments. And if you read it, you'll see that he's pretty clearly mirroring Parmenides on the point of the impossibility of creation from nothing. So insofar as we want to discuss a topic like creation from nothing or how things come to be, it seems that Parmenides had a pretty huge impact on the people that followed. Because, of course, Parmenides is saying there's no such thing as a generation of something new. Like reality doesn't come to be. It always is, because it just is what is. And there's no talk of becoming from what is not. So that point about how things started and how creation began, that seems to have been a huge impact from Parmenides. And you'll see it in the other pre-Socratics. But on the other hand, something you won't see in the other pre-Socratics, which is unfortunate, is that they'll continue to discuss change, and they don't clearly address some of the arguments you find in the Eleatic fragments about change. So they clearly will accept that we can't have creation from nothing. Like, that's just no longer a viable idea. If it ever was for the ancient Greeks, it just isn't, as far as I can tell from these fragments. But the and for later, like 4th century thinkers like Plato and Aristotle. But they still want change. They still want to be able to say, like, a ball rolls down a hill. And the Eleatics raise an argument against the ball rolls down the hill. Because what is the initial way to have a ball rolling down a hill if you admit that there is no creation from nothing? Well, you say the ball exists. It's created out of permanently existing atoms or elements or whatever we want to use. And then we say rolling down the hill is just rearranging those atoms, or it's rearranging the prime material, or however they want to describe it. And then they can say, we didn't create... Oh, sorry, Sola.
No, go ahead and finish that thought. I was going to ask you a question on that, actually, to elaborate further.
Yeah, well, I guess I'm kind of long-winded on the point. All I would getting at is one attempt to say, okay, we're not generating anything new, and we're not destroying anything, we're just rearranging. It seems like, on the face of it, like, okay, that's a pretty nice argument. It's a pretty nice way to get around it. But the Eleatics did posit an argument that never really gets addressed, which is the arrangement itself significant? Is the ball at the top of the hill and the ball at the bottom of the hill, are these two arrangements meaningful? The answer, of course, is yes, because that's how you're doing change, right? You're saying, like, the arrangement at the top and the arrangement at the bottom is different, and that is the change. And then Melissa says, well, you're just creating the arrangement. So it's no way around the problem of our objections to creation, because you're just creating an arrangement instead of a thing, but it's still creation. And that doesn't really get picked up. So, you know, that's a long way of saying there are a lot of arguments that the other pre-Socratics deal with, some arguments I think they don't deal with. But I would always advise people, go pick up the fragments, read them directly, and don't treat the pre-Socratics as memes ever, like the Flux guy or the Love and Strife guy, because they are actually quite deep things, and sometimes they share similarities, and you'll also see at times they part ways.
That's really beautifully put. Is there a particular translation of the fragments that you'd recommend readers, or where they could find that at, or would you just say get it at, like, a bookstore?
Yeah, for Parmenides in particular, I always recommend the Phoenix Pre-Socratics edition. I actually have a copy on my table right here. It's kind of beat up. I've been doing Twitter Spaces with it, so I'm always flicking through it. But the Phoenix Pre-Socratics, the professor who does the translation and the introduction is David Gallup. And I'm actually going to get you how many pages it is. So we go from, here we go. How many pages is this? It's from page 48 to page 91. And those aren't full pages. I mean, those are just like maybe, some of these are just like a couple of paragraphs a page. But the Greek is on one side, so you're half the number, right? So it's really not a lot of fragments to go through. There's not a lot of text to those fragments. You can get through it pretty easily. But the introduction essay is very good. It's a pretty short introduction essay without looking at it. I think it's about 30 pages, maybe. So just a really good little book, Phoenix Pre-Socratics, Parmenides of Elea. I think anyone could pick that up, read the introduction. It's 30 pages. Gives you a nice lay of the land, a bit of the history, some of the ways of interpreting the arguments. And then you dive into the fragments and give them a read. And, you know, I'm not going to say it's going to make you the expert on Parmenides, but it's a great way to go, and it wouldn't take that much time to do. It's a short book.
Thank you. And I know we've already addressed that, for especially the Socratics and pre-Socratics, there were a lot of them pushing back, having agreements and disagreements. I unfortunately would not be qualified enough to know some of the arguments, let's say, that Plato would have or other people would have, but I know sparsely on some Aristotelian pushbacks. I'd love to hear your thoughts on.
Yeah, please. If you can put it forward, that'd be great.
Sure. One of my first things that I remember Aristotle talks about was really a critique of change. So Parmenides, as we already put, he rejected the idea of change and he viewed it as more of an illusion. While Aristotle, on the other hand, believed that change is a fundamental aspect of the natural world. And he would argue that change is real and could be explained through the theory of potentiality and actuality, where things have potential to change and actualize that potential under certain conditions. So an example would, I would plant an acorn, and when I water it, I know during the right conditions, it will become an oak tree, or, you know, what the tree is intended. And I know if I plant an acorn, it's not going to become an orange tree or a palm tree or a fig tree, for example. I'm curious on your thoughts on that, and how would you respond to a lot of the Aristotelian, you know, pushback?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think it goes into the points I was making earlier about getting around the objections to change by talking about rearrangement or reconfiguration. So we'd have to discuss this idea of potency, essentially. But ultimately, it also comes down to how are we interpreting Parmenides? So you mentioned for Parmenides, change would be an illusion. For Aristotle, it's a real part of reality. Again, for my interpretation, I don't think there's a shadow realm of fake change. I think that whatever change there is, whatever appearances or experiences we have, are there in what is. And so to help with viewers picturing it, it's not that Parmenides says the block world, but that's a word I've encountered online in a lot of discussions where people can appreciate the term block world these days, where they see like the whole timeline as complete. Because if we say, you know, I'll get back to Aristotle really quickly, but just in terms of what I view the Parmenidean position on change to be, if we say that reality or what is perfectly complete, then literally everything is complete and it's all in there. And so if we say there's a timeline or a story, like a story of a ball rolling down a hill or a seed turning into an oak tree, if we have this story of a seed becoming an oak tree, all the details of that story are there in being. It's already there. It's already done. It's complete. So it's almost like reality is more like a book. It's all written in the pages already, or a movie. It's all pre-recorded. Obviously, it's more detailed than a book or a movie, but that's why I'm saying I have a block world idea, because it's an unchanging, perfectly complete reality with everything in it already. For the Aristotelian, I don't know if they have this block world idea. They may think that there just is what is actual. So we just have a seed and we drop it into the ground and, you know, we water it. So there you have a seed in the ground, it's watered. And that's the present. It's kind of like a presentist view versus an eternalist view. And then, I don't want to speak for Aristotelians because I would do a terrible job of it, but they may say, you know, that seed in the ground has the potency or the potential to grow into an oak tree. And so then they'll say, and so later we'll get the oak tree. The challenge is, at point number one, where the seed is sitting in the ground and you've watered it, is there an actual oak tree? And the answer is going to be no. There's no actual oak tree anywhere. There's no actual oak tree. There's only a potential oak tree. Then the question becomes, okay, well, is a potential oak tree, or the potency to become an oak tree, or how are we modeling this? Some people will put the potency inside the seed. So they'll say the seed has the potency to become an oak tree. Say, okay, is that potency or that potential oak tree, is that the same as an actual oak tree? Again, the answer is no, because a potential thing or the potency is different from the actual thing. And so then we're just at the beginning again. The challenge was never answered then, because the challenge was you can't generate something new. You can't make what is not what is, because there is no what is not. And so if there is no actual oak tree, and that's been agreed to because there's only a potential oak tree, there's no actual oak tree, then we can't speak of it because there's nothing to speak of. It's just a nothing. And so there needs to be an explanation or a defense of where the actual oak tree, how that could enter the picture, and what is its state when the seed is in the ground. And if we're saying that the potential is distinct from the actual, then that's not actually what we're talking about. I'm talking about the actual oak tree. And I think they tie themselves up in the old problem of having to say that what is not is. which seems to be a direct contradiction to me.
I was going to ask you that question, actually, and I was curious for a bit of a disagreement from the Aristotelian sense. Non-being has a meaningful role in understanding reality, I'd say. For example, potentiality is a form of non-being that is essential to understanding. So let's say for the oak seed, I would think to myself what something can become. And like I said earlier, if I know it's an oak seed and I plant it, I know for certainty if it is water taken care of and grows, it will not become a palm tree or a fig tree. It will become an oak tree. And I think that's what Aristotle would spawn with, if I may be mistaken. Or please correct me if I'm wrong in that, if you know more in that too.
No, I would never presume to speak as, you know, for Aristotle these days. I know that I have parted ways with the Aristotelians, and I know that they know much more than I do about how to interpret Aristotle. It's been a while since I really directly tried to come up with my own interpretation, understanding of Aristotle, as opposed to interacting with people who call themselves Aristotelians and then having these discussions. I would circle back to you, your original statement, which was that non-being is an important part of this process or story, right? I hope I'm fairly understanding what you said. It's like non-being is an important part of change. And essentially Plato says the same thing, right? He has this sort of qualified idea of non-being. But that discussion has to take place before we talk about potency and actuality. We have to understand or explain what we mean by non-being here. Because in my interpretation of Parmenides or the Eleatics, when we say being, there just is what there is, where in that picture is the non-being? If we're saying that non-being is a category inside being, now maybe we can keep talking, because it's like, okay, there's existence writ large, just everything that is, everything that has some sort of affirmative presence or that we can perceive or that we can discuss, just like any sort of affirmative thing we can point to. If we have that big picture of what is, and then someone says, you know, where is non-being? If the person is saying non-being is other than being, is like outside of that picture, then we have a real problem. Because how can you point to it when we already defined that picture as everything you can point at? And so if we're at that point where the person is saying non-being is not in that picture of what is, then I don't think they're consistent. But if we're saying that non-being is inside being, it's like a category in being, so you almost have like being with a big B, capital B being is all that is. And then inside capital B being, you have two categories, like lowercase being and non-being. Then maybe we can figure something out there, because it all is within what is. But I fear that people say non-being, they mean something outside of what is.
Yeah, I'd say a bit of a comparison in a weird way would be almost as Thomists, like Bayesian, for example, would argue he doesn't like fine-tuning argument because it could only bring you to a lowercase g god. It doesn't bring you to a capital G god and a lot of those arguments. But I could definitely see a distinction between, you know, like let's say a capital non-being and a lowercase non-being, where I could see that working.
Yeah, so the capital non-being, so this sort of idea of non-being as distinct from or other than what is, that's what I would be saying is incoherent or inconsistent, can't be done. But if the person is doing a lowercase one, then sure. But I would warn them, or I can't really warn them, they come to their own conclusions about philosophy, but my opinion is going to be that if they're saying there is a capital case being, uppercase being, and then there's being and non-being as two categories wholly subsumed within it, there's a lot of ramifications to that. Because at the beginning of the conversation, we said, you know, the Eleatics, they put forward this argument that there is what there is, and then all of the subsequent arguments necessarily follow from that. And so when the person says, okay, there's just capital being, and then two categories that are wholly subsumed within it, then I'm going to expect them to accept all of the other conclusions of the Eleatics. And they're not going to want to do that. Typically, they're really not going to want to do that.
No, that makes sense. And please let me know if this is a bit semantic. This is just from the top of my head. But if we are describing a non-being as something that has no existence, wouldn't we, in a paradoxical sense, already posit existence by acknowledging non-being exists? So non-being would exist known on being exists, so wouldn't that violate Parmenides' rule?
Yeah, I think you're hitting the nail on the head there, Sola. If we're saying that what is just refers to any sort of affirmative existence, like any sort of presence or anything we can point at, then when we say that there's something outside of it, we're contradicting ourselves, because we're saying, here's this thing that contains everything we can point at, and here's me pointing at something outside of it. It's like, what are you doing, mate? You can't do that. So I think you've hit the nail on the head. It's a direct contradiction. And so in interpreting Parmenides, I'll be really quick. There's a point in the poem at the beginning of the Way of Truth where Parmenides, the goddess, is speaking to the youth and says, look, we can either follow the path of talking about what is, or we can follow the path of talking about what is not. And then throughout the poem, she's saying that path of what is not a real path. It's not consistent. You can't talk about it. You can't point at it. It's just nonsense. And so, yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head. And I think the fragments of Parmenides frequently address that. And that is really a core part of their argument.
Thank you. And a question holding off on some of the critiques for now, but I'm curious to ask. I am not going to be one to doubt the influence that Parmenides has, like you said, both on metaphysics, but would you also said he has a large influence on epistemology as well?
You know, it's when you say a large influence on epistemology, so when you read these fragments and you read a lot of these ancient works, epistemology was not really a word I ever encountered. It seems to be a modern field or a modern term of some sort. I'll just say flat out, I'm not familiar with modern philosophy, and even not really familiar with medieval philosophy. I'm strictly familiar with a particular niche of ancient philosophy. But so epistemology is kind of an odd word for me to use. Insofar as, is Parmenides relevant to discussions of what we can know? Or how we know things, or how certain we can be of things. Yes, highly, highly relevant to that. From two angles. One is, look, if there just is what there is, then whatever you perceive, whatever you're aware of, it is. It has to be in that metaphysical context. So you can't actually perceive what is not. You can't think what is not. Whatever you're thinking, whatever you're doing, whatever you're touching, whatever you're experiencing, it's all going to be found in what is. It's going to have affirmative existential status. And so, you know, we may have... So it becomes a question of, are we describing it well? Are we describing it consistently? But that it is going to be indisputable in my interpretations of Parmenides, because there is only one place to find it. If people turn to the proem, the last few lines of the proem of Parmenides' work, they'll see the goddess says to the youth, I'm going to teach you two things. The one is that it is. The steadfast heart of persuasive truth, that there is what is. And then what's the second part she says? She says, I'm going to teach you about the opinions of mortals. And she concludes by saying, the opinions of mortals have to have genuine existence. So yes, for epistemology, that's an important point there, that if you're perceiving something, it has to be real, because it could not be not real. But, you know, for people interested in epistemology, both Parmenides and Melissus, they speak at length about the problem with the senses, the problem with the way we describe the world. So to wrap it up really quickly, it's like, you know, Melissus uses an example of taking an iron ring, so like a ring made of iron, and you can rub it and you can wear it down. And he's saying, like, you can tell this story of it being rubbed down, but obviously things can't be generated or destroyed. So there's an issue here. So however you want to understand the ring being rubbed down, you have to understand it in a way that it complies with the nature of being. Hence, you may have a block world, right? You may have a complete iron ring, a worn down iron ring, and that story of how it gets worn down. You're going to need to posit the whole story as permanently existing side by side and unchanging, because you can't just destroy the ring and so the iron becomes nothingness or perishes, and a worn ring now comes to be, you know. So yeah, there's a lot of epistemological points there about, hey, you can have these sense perceptions, what you perceive has to be real, but don't get carried away and tell a story that is full of contradictions and involves old sense perception passing away and new ones coming to be, because it all has to be there.
So in a sense, he would reject that our senses a reliable source of knowledge, correct? Or he says it's good to know that, a way and cite that as your source of knowledge then.
Exactly. It's Melissus in particular explicitly says, like, it seems that we're seeing incorrectly. Like, our senses are, you know, however we reach these stories of things changing, something's wrong. Like, we're not, it's not that fire and iron and things can't exist. He says, if they exist, fair enough, but they have to be just as being is. And so to the extent that we have come up with these stories of our senses that aren't consistent with being, then we've done something wrong. Something's gone off the rails.
Okay, and to caveat off that question a bit, I'm curious on the role of reason that has to play as well, because Parmenides, he emphasized the importance of reason over the senses and understanding our reality. But how would you interpret Parmenides' view of reason, and do you think would emphasize more on rationalism in enduring relevance to philosophy, or how would you approach that?
Oh, it's a tough one. The you know, it's I just wish we had his whole poem so we could have a clear understanding of his.
Apologies if I'm pushing some. Sorry if I'm throwing some fastball questions. You've been knocking all my wins out of the park, so I'm like, all right, I'm stepping up a little bit. Yeah.
These are great questions. Thank you for preparing them and throwing them out there. They're great. The in terms of rationalism, I mean, here's a guy that gets interpreted or seen as hyper-rational, almost hyper-rationalistic, because here's a guy who, in the meme interpretation of him, is denying all possible change, like all senses as a term change. It's like he's just logically reached this conclusion that there is what there is, and it couldn't become anything else because there is nothing else to become. And then for most people's reading, that's hyper-rationalistic and in dispute with the sense perception. So yes, if someone who wants to follow reason above the senses, if they can be put in this weird dichotomy against each other, then they probably view him as a kind of a superhero or a superhuman philosopher who's just gone to the point of denying everything that the senses might tell us. I don't read him as putting senses and reason in stark contrast to each other so much as there are the senses and they have to have genuine existence. Again, that last line in the proem there. But clearly in seeing how all the different sense perceptions hang together, people may misuse their reason and tell a contradictory story. And so reason definitely is very important if they're going to tell a consistent story of how all their sense perceptions and experiences hang together.
Okay, thank you. And we already touched a bit on the relations between Parmenides and Heraclitus. I was doing some research preparing for this podcast and stumbled upon the term elatism. And sorry if I'm mispronouncing that, but apparently people are saying Parmenides is often grouped together with other elatic philosophers, such as Zeno. And I was curious by your view, how would you see Parmenides' philosophies as distinct from or similar to the elatic thinkers, such as like Zeno? And what role would you see it has to play among the others?
Yeah, this is it's an interesting question trying to piece together the Eleatic school. So you mentioned Zeno, obviously you mentioned Parmenides, and we've mentioned Melissus, right? These are the three big Eleatic philosophers of the 5th century BC. And you mentioned Zeno in particular. Zeno is the least well-preserved of those three. So we have some paradoxes that are preserved, usually just someone giving an account of what the paradox was. But it's not like Zeno handed us a poem or an essay that we have today that really shows his thought. So it would be a little tricky. There are some points where we could say, oh, maybe here Zeno has a disagreement with Parmenides, but it's kind of trickier to color that one in. But I can give a good contradiction between Parmenides and Melissus, if you like.
Sure, feel free to.
Yeah, so there's a dispute about whether or not Parmenides and Melissus are consistent about whether being is limited or unlimited, you know, finite or infinite. And so for Parmenides in the poem, he sort of draws this picture of what is, this like the whole of reality or being, and it's held fast in great chains. It's kind of fenced in. It is what it is. And it's no more, no less, and it doesn't become something else, and it doesn't perish. So his view of being, as he's describing it, has very, the language is like limited or finite. It just, it is what it is, perfectly complete, and doesn't get added to, and it can't grow, and it can't shrink, and it can't die or pass away. So when we go to Melissus, who again is one of those big three Eleatic thinkers of the 5th century, he describes being as unlimited or infinite or apeiron. And so it's like, oh, why do we have Parmenides saying that it's essentially this hemmed in, fenced in, or like held fast in chains, complete thing? Oh, yeah, go on.
Oh, I was just going to say, continue elaborating. I was disagreeing.
Yeah, no worries. And so we wind up with one talking about it as finite, and we have the other one talking about it as seemingly infinite. And so when we go to Melissus, we have to ask, you know, well, one, Parmenides and Melissus, are they going from the same arguments, like same underlying assumptions? Yes. So for Parmenides and for Melissus, whether they call being finite or infinite, it's based on the fact that there just is what there is. There just is. And so for Parmenides, because there only is, there's nothing it could become. There's no way for it to grow. It's just complete and is what it is. And it's held fast as it is. And then for Melissus, because there only is what there is, or there just is this one, he calls it the one. He has his own language, and he writes in an essay format rather than a poem, but we'll call it the Melissian one. So for the one, it's alone, and so there's nothing bordering it. There's nothing hemming it in. There's no second object weighing against it or pressing against it. And so he can say that the one or being is unlimited, because to be limited or to have a border or to be fenced in would require some other thing pressing against it. But really, it is just all that is, and there's just, you know, there's nothing holding it in. And for Parmenides, of course, his point is coming up from a different angle, but working from the same underlying assumption. And essentially, you can make these people commensurate. You can put them into accord. Some people will not want to put them in accord. They will look for a different interpretation where they'll say Melissus and Parmenides differ on this point of whether being is finite or infinite. So there's a lively discussion about that point. That's one point where at least the language is different, and there's a discussion as to whether they parted ways or whether they're making the same point from the same underlying fact, but from different angles, or just kind of like building on each other's thought.
All right, thank you. And I'll ask one more question, then we're going to take a quick break. But some people would argue that Parmenides' philosophy, as we all agree, is primarily metaphysical. But there are other scholars, interpreters, who would argue that it also has ethical implications to it. How would you interpret any ethical implications, if there are any? And what do you think that brings between thought and behavior for people?
Yeah, that's interesting that people would think of him as an ethical thinker. And I say it's interesting because sadly the 5th century, or sadly, or maybe it's good, the 5th century Eleatic thinkers, they're very focused on these metaphysical arguments. You know, they make this point about being, and they very much focus on what necessary inferences or what conclusions can we draw from that idea of reality as a complete whole. So they don't explicitly, there's no fragments of Parmenides, Zeno, or Melissus where they're explicitly saying, you know, here is an ideal constitution for a state, or here is how two people should act in a certain circumstance, or here is the definition of good and evil. But there are there are moral ramifications for the thought. There is a later thinker who is sometimes paired with the earlier three people we mentioned. His name's Diodorus Cronus. He's discussed at length by Sextus Empiricus. He's not usually called an Eleatic, but he's usually called a dialectician or Megarian. But Sextus says his teaching is that we all have eternal life. And so if we all have eternal life, we're indestructible. Surely that has some ramifications for how we think about life and death. And life and death is obviously caught up in a lot of ethical conversations and thoughts of the afterlife and worries that we have. So there are some big ramifications. And I believe we are, just like being is not destroyed, nothing can perish and nothing can be generated. I don't think that we are in danger of being destroyed or generated. And so in a sense, yes, we do have eternal life, and that's an ethical point, and clearly a later day Eleatic like Diodorus explicitly held that viewpoint. But it's tough to look at these 5th century fragments and really reach clear moral arguments. The morality was, it's almost like the next generation really picks up that torch of discussing ethics. Like you mentioned Socrates. So Socrates is a young man when Parmenides is old, right? It's really Socrates' generation that I would say really get into the ethics stuff a lot harder. Parmenides is pretty clearly metaphysical in my mind.
All right. Thank you very much for that. I just want to let you know, Tweefon, again, thank you for being on. This has been an absolute pleasure and enjoyment for us discussing, and I applaud you for how vast your knowledge is when it comes to metaphysics, and thank you for helping me push to mine. But a really quick shout-out I want to make. I want to thank Athenian Stranger, Ancient Philosophy, Alejandro, and John Boyer for being some of the four people, and yourself included, for being some of the people who are regulars in my philosophy spaces that help push me further in a lot of these things. And I definitely say metaphysics is one of my weak suits, but I'm glad we're having this conversation because it's helping a lot.
Oh, thank you, Sola. It's always a pleasure talking with you about philosophy in general. I've been in a number of your spaces. When I see them up at the top of the Twitter app or X app these days, I always try to jump in. They're always good. And I recommend anyone who sees you on Twitter, just give you a follow and jump in because discussions are always good.
Thank you very much. And I'm going to ask you one more question as well, and then I'm sure Hazy's going to come in. He's back now. He's going to ask you a couple questions. But I was curious on your thoughts for an ontological status of appearance. So Parmenides, please correct me, this is my interpretation of it, where he argued that appearances, like we said, are deceptive and do not correspond to, you know, a true reality. And I'm sure it's very discussed, a true reality, fake reality. But how would you understand Parmenides' concept of appearance? And what implications do you think that has on our understanding of relationships between what is appearance and what is reality?
Yes, that's a core question for any interpretation of Parmenides. It's, remember when we said the poem has three parts? There's a proem, the way of truth, and the way of seeming. Everyone, well, I mean, the proem is his arrival at the, you know, to see the goddess and begin the philosophical journey. But any interpretation is going to have to reach some conclusion about the significance of the way of truth or what is, and the way of seeming and how they relate to each other. And there's a way that you can go, which I think you were hinting at, which is that idea of a dualist Parmenides almost. It's like you have the real reality and the appearance or way of seeming or illusory reality. And that's a very Platonist view of looking at it. People like Simplicius hold that, where you have like this like two-level reality. My reading of Parmenides is that appearance is actually part of truth. It is the truth. Because at the very end of the poem, and also just because it makes sense to me, but at the end of the poem, again, it's that line where she says, I'm going to teach you two things. One is a steadfast heart, a persuasive or well-rounded truth, depending on which fragment or reading of it you have. So that is what is, like that broad thing that there just is, the truth is. And then she's going to tell him about the opinions of mortals. And yeah, the opinions of mortals have trouble, but have problems, but they have to have genuine existence. And so if opinions or appearances or sense data has to have genuine existence, I think the goddess is saying that appearances, opinions, whatever, it's found in the truth. Like it's there in the truth because it just is what is. And so appearances are right there in what is. And so I wind up in a position where whatever appears to you, whatever you perceive or sense is absolutely real. There's no fake perception. The question, though, is how are we describing it? How are we understanding it? And so it's like that line in Melissus that we went over about rubbing an iron ring down. Or maybe we say like there's a fire, like there's some wood on fire, and then tomorrow there's just ashes. Are we going to take those two bits of sense perception, the wood on fire and then the ashes the next day, and say, oh, the fire became the ashes and the fire is no more? Well, what's the metaphysical understanding here? Are we saying that the fire is now a nothing? No. So for Melissus, he's saying, look, you can have a fire, you can have water, you can have all these things, but they all are what they are, and they're invincible, or there's nothing stronger than their fact of existence, and they don't go anywhere. And so you wind up with a block world vision. So for me, yeah, whatever appears to you, whatever you sense, you really are, it really is something. Otherwise, we wouldn't be talking about it. But the challenge becomes how to effectively describe it without contradicting yourself.
And my question to that would be, following the logical implications, is what do we do for things that can be perceived through the mind as illusions? So an example, someone who suffers from, let's say, schizophrenia, they would see things that aren't truly there or hear things that aren't truly heard. And it would be a bit macabre for me to tell someone who suffers from any of these disorders that, yes, there are people in your wall, or yes, there are bugs in your skin. You wouldn't say that's true. How would you approach that? By saying there is a faultiness in your appearance of that thing?
Yeah, I mean, you would start by saying they really are suffering something. I mean, you wouldn't say they're pretending to hear voices. I mean, if we're assuming that this person's genuinely having these sense perceptions, they're not like trying to trick us with a fake story about sense perceptions, but you would begin by saying, yeah, you really are having some sort of experience. But from your perspective, Soli, you would look, so he's let's say there's someone who's like ranting and raving and says there's aliens in the wall. If you go look in the wall and there's no aliens, what do you have? You have a guy who's clearly undergoing some sort of experience or frightening it, like something's frightening him, and he's pointing at the wall and the wall has no aliens in it. So you can see a contradiction there. You know that his description of the wall is inaccurate. There's just, it's not consistent, because the wall without aliens is not a wall with aliens. Like, that would just be a direct contradiction to say that that which has no aliens in it has aliens in it. So you can just say, like, that's a contradiction. So you can't really describe reality as, if he thinks there's aliens in the wall, there are aliens in the wall. But at the same time, he's clearly suffering something. So you have to go and examine what it could be that he's experienced, or what it could be that he's suffering, and try to come up with a consistent account where the wall really has no aliens, because you check, there are no aliens there. But the guy is still having some sort of perception or sense perception, or is mentally unwell. So I think that would be the beginning of your examination or explanation there. And I think, thankfully, you don't have to tell someone like, oh, it's fake. There's no, you're not feeling anything. You can say, yeah, you're feeling something, but you're not quite grasping what it is. Let me try and help you. We'll discover what it is. And maybe he needs medication or whatever.
Well, the question for me at that point would be, what would you say to someone who is evaluating the same ink block, but they're seeing something like two hands together and someone else is seeing an octopus? Like, do these, both of these perceptions, like, have weight in reality, or is someone misinterpreting what is occurring in front of them? Like, sure, there is schizophrenia, and sure, there is a psychosis that breaks you from reality, or that there are synapses firing in such a degree in which it's creating something that feels just as tangible as reality is. But what about perception in that regard?
Yeah, you know, the in addition to the pre-Socratics, I think, I assure you, I'm not, I'll answer the question, but I think people should really also consider the sophists here. And I don't mean sophists in a bad way, but people like Protagoras, who say, people like Protagoras, they discuss man as a measure of things, but also it's like each person has a particular perspective and is what they are. And so they relate to everything else differently just by that fact. So the way I relate to an image is different than the way you relate to the image, because inherently I am me and you are you. There's some difference or distinction there, and that'll bleed out into how everything relates to each other. If we're looking at the same, like someone, I guess, throws some paint on the wall and you say it's two hands praying and I say it's an octopus, there's no clear contradiction there. There is the fact that when I look at that in my mind or whatever, however we're going to describe a human, in the mind or the brain or the soul or whatever, the way that I would relate to that, my synapses or my soul or whatever immediately goes, oh yeah, an octopus. I love octopuses, and that kind of looks like one. And I wouldn't associate it with clasped hands, because, you know, maybe that's a symbol of praying in church or something. I don't often go to church, so I don't, that symbol doesn't occur to me much. But then you would say, hey, that's clasped hands, and maybe you've never seen an octopus. So you have to allow for these different perspectives. And I don't think it's necessarily a contradiction there so much as it's just acknowledging that two different perspectives will always be a little different. It could be a lot different if we're different animals or something.
And if I may entertain you both with a hypothetical question I was thinking of, let's say I show up to the beach and I carve into the sand the figure that is the number 6. I know I draw on the number 6, and in my mind, I know I originally intended it to be the number 6. And later, I bring Hazy, and I make him stand in front of it so he sees the number 6, and I get Tweetavon, you, to stand on the opposite side so you see the number 9, and I ask you, what is it? And Hazy, of course, would say, well, this is the number 6, while you'll say this is the number 9. I wouldn't really agree with the notion, well, you're both right, because I could say, I know one of you guys are wrong because of the original tension of what I draw and what the number is. You just don't fully know it yet. How would you respond to that notion?
I think at this point, I'm just not going to go to the beach with you. Can I be playing these
games? Go to the beach and like talk metaphysics. I'm like, all right, guys, here we are. Look, I just want to play in the water.
Off the top of my head, I think my first response is going to be, there's a distinction between a thing and its description, or a thing in the way we see it, and a thing in the way it was intended by its creator, yourself drawing it out. It's like if I describe the number 6 to you, I could describe what it looks like when it's drawn, but the actual a drawn number 6 itself is different from the collection of words. So there's got to be some sort of distinction here where I can be correct in saying, like, from where I'm standing, this thing that you carved out in the sand would be a 6. And then Hazy can say, where I'm standing, it this way it's carved out, it looks like a 9. And then you can say, well, I had this intention when I was drawing it that it would be a 9 and not a 6. And all those facts, I think, can be brought together in harmony in a big picture. I don't think that I would say that because you drew the thing on the beach with the intention that it be a 6, if someone else comes along and looks at it and says it's a 9, they're inherently wrong, because it's sort of like your intention and the thing itself, there's a distinction there. It's sort of like if an author writes a book, do you have to perceive his intention for the way the words will be written, or has it been put into ink and a person will see it and can reach their own conclusions or make their own suspicions of what the author might have been thinking, or not even care about the author at all. It's just a common language, and they'll come to their own ideas about what it could mean. So I think because there are all these different perspectives, and because words and the things they describe and our plans and the events themselves when they're carried out are all distinct and might differ, this whole picture has to admit of some differences. I don't think they're direct contradictions in the sense of saying is and is not. There is that which is not would be a direct contradiction. I think it's a different question, but still very interesting. And also, again, it just makes me think of the sophists, because these are the sorts of questions that I think were really alive in the late, mid-late 5th century and early 4th century in Athens. I think a lot of those sophists that people are always down on, I think if they go and read some of their fragments and read some of the secondhand accounts of them, they were wrestling with a lot of these questions. Like when you're talking about epistemology, that's like right up their avenue. So I think a lot of these questions they're really reminding me of those people.
So you would say that like these two interpretations have equal merit and weight, or would you say that
I would say here's Hazy's interpretation. Like from Hazy's perspective, given these angles, here's what it looks like. And given Tweedafon's perspective, this is what it looks like. And when we
draw, neither one of them would lend more credence, but neither one of these interpretations would lend more credence, correct? If Solo were to vulture the information that he did in fact create it as such to be interpreted as a 9, that information wouldn't alter its interpretation or the value of our interpretation, correct?
Well, the value is almost going to be relative to the question or who is speaking. So if the question was, what was Sola's meaning in drawing this number here? Then now that's a different question. That's a big issue. And you would be the one correct and I would be the one incorrect. And when I say incorrect, it would just be an inconsistency or a contradiction, because I'm saying, well, it's a number, what did I say, 6? And Sola intended it to be a 9. Well, a 9 is not a 6, and so it would be a contradiction to say that I'm right, because you would be calling a 9 a 6. So if the question is, what was Sola's intention? Then yeah, you've got the right answer, I don't. But I still have my interpretation. I still have my perspective looking at it, and that's just as real as everything else. So it really depends on the question being asked. But in the big picture, all the perspectives are there, all the information is there, and you really just depends on what the particular question being asked is. But nothing is more or less real, so to speak. There's no gradation, hierarchy of being.
Would the internal monologue be like just as equally as important as someone's external evaluation?
Well, these terms like important, it's I suppose we need to discuss what makes something important. Like, what is the context or system? Because again, if the question is like, let's say we go to the beach together and Sola says, "I drew this amazing number in the sand. You guys got to see it. If you understood the meaning of what I drew in the sand, you'd be enlightened." And we go out there and you know, you understand it. And so you become enlightened. And I just don't get it. I don't even know how to read it. I don't know numbers. I don't know my numerals. Then I'm just, you know, that is a pretty important difference, right? Because ideally the mission was to go out there and understand what Sola has written and become more learned. And I just couldn't do it because I don't know my numerals, and you did. So it is pretty important. But to call something important, I think we need a broader discussion about what makes something important. Because obviously it's not simple existence, like the fact that it is, because something can exist and be relatively unimportant to a question. So, yeah.
Yep. definitely interesting. So when you talk about how would you define importance in this context, like how would you evaluate it?
I almost need to get away from the beach example then, because, you know, obviously looking at a number on the sand, I don't know if I'd ever personally feel it is important. I mean, if we are not positing a particular question, so there's no particular question on the table, and someone just comes up to us and says, "You lot, what's important in life?" I'm going to say, well, what's important in life is what is conducive to my nature, like what allows me to express what I am and be what I am and flourish. And that's sort of going to be the best answer I can give from my perspective. And then if I want to say it more broadly, I would say, you know, what is important or what is morally good or right or ought to be is for all life or all will to be fulfilled. Like we get our nourishment, we can have families, and we can express ourselves and engage all of our faculties, because that's what our nature is. And so what is important, just generally speaking, if you're asking me, it's going to be a moral answer. And my morality is going to be informed by nature, like what we are, how we express what we are. And so that would be my measure of what's important, just very generally. It's going to be that sort of moral one rooted in nature. And the and as for looking at numbers on a beach, you know, it's important if we're just playing a game together, like who can guess what Sola was thinking, but it's not big picture, just general, something of importance.
Good question. So you said nature earlier, and it seems to be like a collective, like, invocation of it, or is it just like a personal interpretation? There's like underlying implicit understanding that unifies us, or are you just speaking as like what you're maximizing enjoyment of?
No, and I'm not. I'm looking just for maximizing enjoyment. You know, we talked earlier, and I said there were things in Aristotle and Plato that I really appreciated and enjoyed, and I still find very valuable to read. I really enjoy reading parts of the Nicomachean Ethics, for example. I do like some of Plato's dialogues. Maybe not so much these days, but ones like Gorgias and stuff. There's some good moral works there, and I'm talking about them because, you know what, there's a certain biology almost in Aristotle's work where he's like, you know, what does an organism need to flourish or succeed? Like what causes it to succeed or do well? And what does it need? And so let's not talk about humans. Let's talk about cats, for example. You can look at a cat and say, okay, it has a nature, what it is to be a cat. It needs to eat. It needs to drink water. It needs to catch mice. It needs to get some sunlight. These are pretty objective. It's not just like what the cat might tell you if it could talk. It's not just what I like. It's something written into the biology of a cat. Just like I think there's something written into what we are. Because each thing is what it is, and it is a certain way. And so humans are a certain way, cats are a certain way, and because we're alive, we can feel good, or we can feel, you know, we can have pleasure, like you were saying, but we also have a sense of fulfillment and a certain direction that we're moving in. And so that will either be fulfilled or it will be frustrated. And so I don't think it's necessarily just whatever you want or whatever makes you feel good. I mean, it's really a broader question of how do you fulfill your nature and fully be what you are.
I completely agree with that to some degree. But I would say that like a cat and an animal to some degree has a more simplistic framework of like the world and as it exists. For most animals, you just take care of the basic amenities. You're ensure yourself that you're like have a happy animal at the end of the day. You're just going to have a creature that's going to love you unabashedly. But for human beings, all these amenities could be fulfilled, and yet there could be a barrenness to the soul itself in a more way of expressing. Some people can have all their immediate needs taken care of. This could be hunger, a roof over the head, immediate friends, and yet there's still a flaw or a brokenness to their personhood that can even lead to self-destruction. So while animals to some degree can have all these things completed and never want for more, human beings can have equally all these same things completed for them and still yearn for more to the point of self-destruction. How would you alleviate that underlying aspect that could arise?
Yeah, no, I agree with you that humans have a broader range of needs or desires and that need to be fulfilled. We're clearly more complex psychologically than like a mouse. I wouldn't sell all animals short. I mean, you know, every so often you hear a story of a dolphin who's lonely and depressed. So, you know, animals also have a need to interact with other animals. But no, I agree with you that it's not just a calculation of, oh, well, we gave him this many calories and there's a shelter to sleep in and that's the end of the story. No, the beauty of works like the Nicomachean Ethics and others has a more full understanding of what it is to be a human. So, yeah, I don't want to pretend that a human is just a bag of organs that calories and water go in and it needs a certain amount of sleep. I guess the question was almost like, how do I fulfill all the needs of a human? And that's a really big question. I mean, I think that's part of the philosophical project, especially for morality, because it was enough for me to say, broadly speaking, that what is important or what ought to be, this idea of morality, I'm rooting it in the nature of what it is to be a living thing. And each living thing has a particular type of nature, like a cat is different from a human. And so generally we know where to put the good and evil there. If the guy is starving to death or depressed and wants to kill himself or something horrible, then obviously that's in the evil camp because it's frustrating, not enabling him to be or express his nature. And if he's succeeding and doing well and raising a family and meeting all of the, you know, all of the needs and aspects of his nature, then obviously that's good. And then in the broad picture, you want a harmony where we can all do that. But to ask, like, in particular, how would I plan out a society or a lifestyle in a given environment to successfully hit all of those needs? That's a very particular question and is really like a project in its own right. It's like almost like one of those projects of a lawgiver, like Plato or Solon or someone who sets out to say, okay, I'm going to write the laws and we'll have a colony and this is how many people will be on it. It'll be on an island. These are the ways that they can worship. These are the ways they can work the field. This is how they'll have children and marry, etc. Like it's a really big project to say how to plan out the ideal human life and an ideal society. But just generally, that's where I find morality. It's in the success or frustration of organisms.
There shall be a King Sola, and he'll rule over many nations. Total
monarchy. There you go. Total monarchy. Absolute monarch.
Jokes aside, though, Hazy, A few nights ago, I opened up a Twitter space discussing what is morality, and Tweetaflow and I went back for, what was it, roughly an hour and a half, me and you, talking about, is a lion immoral for eating the gazelle? And then we were both nearly having a stroke going back and forth on that. It was an enjoyable conversation, though.
Oh, I wish I could have heard this gazelle, the big gazelle question. I wish I could have heard that.
Yeah. It's just like, you know, Tweetaflow in his like very lucrative accent being like, well, of course it is and this, and I'm over here like, no, 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 no. It is definitely an enjoyable conversation, though.
Yeah, well, it was a good conversation. You know, there's so many details to discuss. There's also like ideas of what the final picture should look like. So for me, I think the final picture, when we describe the world and morality, is going to involve both good and evil. So I think all the animals that we know of on Earth and humans are clearly imperfect creatures, and they're all existing together in the same environment and clashing with each other. So a lion and a gazelle, I don't mean to bring up that conversation again, although it was a good one, but I expect them to clash and there to be a both, in any given event, a mixture of good and evil, just because we're imperfect and all trying to get along.
When we invoke, just so the audience is on the same page, when the words good and evil just in expressed succinctly, like what is the main message? Like when you describe good and evil, are you just describing like the bad that is incurred upon a being, or is that the probably like the simplest way to prescribe it?
So obviously, if we use terms like good and evil, it's, as you're suggesting, it's a really good idea to define them first so we know what we're trying to say. I'm not going to mention that space again. Let's not use lion.
He really, yeah, really wanted to. He was like, dang, I really just want to just use this offhand.
Yeah, I think Saul wants to jump in. I'm going to change it to something else. But we have to define these terms, right? So I would have morality as a system we're discussing, and good and evil are presumably two different sides of this scale, or at least two opposing terms within this context of a moral system. And when I say something is good, I mean it's conducive to the will or nature of an animal. It allows that thing to flourish. And if I say it's bad or evil, then I'm saying essentially the opposite. So we were mentioning Heraclitus earlier, right? I wish I had his fragments in front of me. There's a fragment that I sometimes like to quote, which is...
Not for clarification, but I think an easier way to apply this is to say that we're enacting a level of evil onto like cattle, for instance. Would you say that we're enacting a level of evil because it's net good it does for society at large is protein or sustenance for a large scale amount of people?
Yeah, I mean, if a cow wants to live and is continuing to grow, like let's do, I don't know, what is it? It's like a veal or whatever is a baby cow. You know, it wants to grow and flourish and dance around in the meadow and stuff. And then
ideally, ideally.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Ideally, yeah, ideally. It has this ought to be or this desire or direction just in its nature. And it's cut down and then eaten. Now, I think it cuts down pieces of grass when it rips them out of the ground and chews it and eats it. It's all a matter of, you know, the intensity or weight to be given to it.
Interesting.
But yeah, you essentially get...
With that being said, can I touch on that just a second?
Yeah,
are you saying that, like, that chain of events detaches the moral coding of that action? Or is it just... It removes any semblance of it being a moral action by saying that there is a domino effect within the sequence of events. If I were to say, well, there is this harmless, neurologically like vacuous like thing on the ground that is eaten by cows, which makes my actions just as equally morally vacuous to it to like incur upon like the cow that is like more like cognizant. Is that like what is being said?
Oh, I see how am I weighing them. Yes, I mean, yeah, it's a whole discussion of how to weigh the good and evil acts. Obviously, I don't. Like, I was running around in the grass with my kids earlier, crushing plenty of, you know, stalks of grass. I don't care about grass. But I'm just using it as the most minimal, you know, I personally would weigh that as extremely minimal. A cow, it presumably is more aware of what it wants and can suffer pain and etc. So, yeah, I would consider killing a cow as long as it's aware of it and feels it, I would consider that to be more serious than crushing grass. But at the same time, I'm not striving for perfect reality here. I just don't view reality as perfect. And I don't think that us ceasing our actions or not killing cows is an answer that's good. Because just the nature of planet Earth and everything on it, there's going to be a mix of good and evil. And, you know, that cow's just not going to... What are we supposed to be, the slave of the cow and, like, raise all the cows to old age and pamper them? No, we got to do something with them. Or banish them. If we banish them, they're just going to be eaten by other animals or starve. And certainly we're not going to subordinate ourselves to the veal. This is an interesting discussion in its own right, but I don't expect there to be a pure good answer.
Excellent argument against veganism, by the way. Thank you, Tweetafon. jokes aside, really quick thing, and then we're going to go over and start talking about Tweetafon's book. But during that conversation, I got so absorbed into it that I abruptly asked him, the question of, like, well, what about things that go from, non-existence to existence, from nothing to something? And he immediately retorted with, oh, I don't believe in that silly nonsense. And the moment he said that, just reflexively, I felt the spirit of Athenian stranger enter my body, and my left fist nearly went straight through the wall next to me during that conversation. It was purely reflexive. But
it was that ironically, like that black guy meme who punches through the laptop.
Yeah, I was so close from this being like, son of a bitch, and it's like straight through. But no, it was a good conversation, but definitely. But I actually am looking forward to this segment of the podcast, but we have here a copy that I was able to receive by Fawn and Alia. And of course, let's open her up a little bit. And a good old, it has come to my attention that Sola is buried in John. Sound of my tweet, Fawn. That was a very little heart-touching thing you included there for me. All good. But so my first question I have for this book, one, it's very remarkably impressive. I've been reading it so far, but what inspired you to make this book or create it?
Well, first, thank you for giving it a read. I'm glad you enjoy it so far. The for a while now, I've always had like little hobbies where I made like a basic video game that's up on Steam. I've always also been engaging in various philosophy discussions, maybe make like little audio recordings as well, and it just kind of. It was both a project that I just took up after I finished the prior project, and I wanted to produce something new that could be sent out there. It's like when I made a video game. It's like you make it, you complete it, and you can put it out there. And then I was like, okay, well, I'm having all these philosophical discussions. I want some sort of affirmative text that I can put out there that people can read and enjoy. And so it was just happened to be the next project that I worked on, and it served a purpose because it was like an affirmative statement, an affirmative philosophical text that people could hold and read and enjoy. So I always try to have these little projects. After I wrote that book, I started another project. I should be putting more hours into it if I can. Obviously, I have a job as well. But the and then I'm sure one day I'll come back and I'll write another book, maybe a sequel to that one. It's just good to have hobbies or side projects where you have sort of a labor of love or a passion project that you can create and then put out the door, and it's like something that people can hold and enjoy and read or play. And it's like hey, why let Plato have all the fun writing his dialogues? Why let Parmenides write a poem? We're just like them. We're people too, and we're discussing the same topics. And I don't have to be a professor to write a book. I don't need to be a game developer to make a game. If I feel some passion to do it, I'm doing it anyway online, like we would in the space arguing about lions and gazelles and discussing morality. Like, we're part of that same universe. Like, we are like them, and I'm going to produce my own text. And here's a new Eleatic book, and you can put it right there next to Parmenides and Melissus, and maybe someone will say it's bad, but hey, I'm right there arguing the same things with them, and go read it. So, yeah, it's just I just felt that urge, and it's just a hobby and a passion project, really.
And if I may, would you be okay if I read the first paragraph really quick of The Arrival?
Yeah, sure.
So you have in The Arrival, it says this. You hike along a forested path, occasionally catching sight of your destination through the towering trees and dense foliage. It was an easy decision to make this journey. after listening to one too many theological debate, you desired something more certain than talk of gods and their plans for humanity. You set out after encountering a forum post that revealed a greater context to reality, one that stretched beyond the gods and swallowed them whole. I really like that. That's a pretty powerful intro, and you're kind of like putting it on the table, throwing your cards down with that one. So in this book, Ilya, what inspired you to have the setting of almost the arrival and, you know, you meeting people along your journey and discussing things with them?
Well, I mean, the first paragraph you read out there is, it's almost sort of the journey of how I came to be doing this in a lot of ways. It's having all these discussions. Before we had Twitter, obviously we were on internet forums. I've been on internet forums for decades now, having these sorts of discussions, debating, you know, should I be part of this religion or this philosophical school or whatnot? And at the point where I was writing this book, I had reached a point where, okay, I believe the Eleatics in the broadest sense are the correct teaching or school. And so, you know, here it is. We're going to write this book and arrive at this place. And I think a lot of people have a similar experience of being on the internet and having these discussions. And now they want to, you know, continue having these debates or reach some sort of great conclusion about the broadest context. But in terms of the format of it, being a branching novel and the like that, I can't stand modern philosophy books. I read a few by professors. It's just so painful and dry to read and uninteresting. And if you don't agree with something they say, unless they argue it in detail in the immediately following paragraph, it may spoil the next 20, 30, 50 pages of the book, because you might be like, all right, you're making this detailed argument, but I disagreed with you about point one, and everything lives or dies by point one. And so what am I to do with the next 100 pages if we're not going to address point one? And I could, just for academic purposes, could continue to read and think about it. But what I really wanted to address wasn't there, and I had no way of disagreeing and no way of easily going to some other part of the book. It's just like this one linear thing that you just have to follow through, and at times just reads like a lecture note or something. Whereas everyone loves reading something like Plato's Dialogues, right? There are characters. They have a whole bunch of topics. It's more exciting. And so in terms of the style of, like, you know, you arrive at this valley, you're going to visit this temple. It's like hearkening back to a more enjoyable way of doing philosophy and writing. It's just more enjoyable to read. And in the book, when there's something that you don't agree with or you don't like, what I tried to do was two things. One is let you ask a question if possible and try to clarify it more. But two is you can just walk away. Like when you first enter the temple and there's that guy talking in the dark to himself, giving a monologue. That's a very sort of Melissian, like Melissa-style monologue. If you think it's all silly, you'll see there's an option there where you can just go get lunch. You just walk away and go get lunch. You don't bother with it. And you have more of a talk about Taoist philosophy at that point. So there's also a way that you can just allow the reader to avoid boring sections that they disagree with. And they can come back, you can circle around to it later, but you just got to let them have a more pleasurable reading experience. Maybe put in something that kind of made Platonic Dialogues and the like so enjoyable, or these Parmenidean stories about a goddess so enjoyable. And just do something better than what's being churned out in some of the works that I was reading from today that I just, personally, I just wasn't enjoying.
I would say that it's similar to, especially how biting and inviting that passage was alone. I would compare it to Allegory of the Caves, where it entices you with this story of how perception is. And before you really get a notion as to what the argument is, it's more about how the story is going to conclude. Whereas if you read Farquhar's like story, Sex and Power, there's a part in that book that it was hard to digest before I got into the arguments. But he was talking about public displays of intimacy amongst like adolescents, and I was like, I feel like we need to address that. But then the book kind of like doesn't get into that until like the very end of it. So it's like, it's a big pill to kind of hold, or it's like a big weight to hold until the very end of it. Whereas there's something very enticing that really behooves you to read the rest of it before you come to conclusions about the argumentation of it. If something is structured strongly as an argumentation, the rejection of the first premise becomes harder. It makes it completely incapable of digesting the rest of what is like being said. Like if I disagree with first premise, we can't go anywhere else. So I think that's a good
having way a story. Yeah, having a story lets them kind of welcomes them in, draws them into the story before you dump a bunch of philosophy on their head and allowing them a chance to branch off and do stuff. I just think for the reader, it's a much better experience and much more enjoyable. And even if they don't agree, there's still something they can appreciate.
No, definitely is something I've been noticing as well, because I believe you spoken earlier offline that you said this is a book that some people are not going to agree with, and you're completely okay with that because there's something for. And I like how a lot of like the intro to me is very much homaging to Plato's Republic, how the intro of Plato's Republic is literally just that philosophers, you know, at an area just discussing and talking amongst each other, and you're kind of walking around the room, if you will, seeing all the conversations that are going on and listening in.
You're right. At the beginning of the Republic, they're walking along and they get dragged into the philosophy debate, right? There's a youth that comes up and says, hey, come over to my dad's place. We gotta chat. I just think this is a superior way to do philosophy if we're going to write something. And we have this ancient example of it. I mean, obviously the ancients didn't write in a branching novel or choose your own adventure format. So that's something maybe that's a modern innovation. And I'm sure Sola and Hazy, maybe you guys grew up reading choose your own adventure books. I know I did. And also just, you know, playing role-playing games and stuff. They all have these branching narratives. It's just, maybe it's a modern art form as well that, I'm not saying I do it well, but I think that's something that moderns have really added to the picture of art and philosophy is a branching paths, because, you know, there are no choose your own adventure books from antiquity. There's very little in the way of branching argumentational novels in the way of choosing different paths to follow. And I think it really adds something to the experience and is sort of a good modern contribution. Not that I say I do it well, but it's at least just to do that at all is from my perspective, something really positive and like a real genuine bit of, modern people, 20th century, they've really added something to the art or experience and maybe come up with their own style that really I don't know if it existed prior.
And if I may ask a bit of from your personal writings of this, what would you say would be your favorite part, if you have one, in the literature? Is there any specific, you know, dialogue that you enjoy most in Elia between two people, or ones that you feel like would be almost a magnum opus of this?
I wouldn't discuss anything I produce as a masterpiece. I'd almost be embarrassed to say that I made a masterpiece. But
I'm speaking purely from your personal opinion. What is something you enjoyed most writing, or like what scene or chapter do you enjoy most?
Yeah, so I mentioned the monologue that you encounter where the man is speaking in the dark by himself. You read the opening line of The Arrival, and of course you arrive, there are two people that greet you, they give you a welcome guide, answer a couple of basic questions, and then you go into the temple. And there's really not too much philosophy, like dense philosophy or metaphysics, that occurs prior to you entering the temple. But when you go in, of course, you enter the main room and it's dark and there's a person giving this monologue, practicing a speech. And I've always been pretty happy or proud of that opening speech there. It's kind of like the readers come in, he's gotten the initial story. There hasn't really been any dense philosophy. There's been a bit of cheekiness, like saying that you can't drink coffee, you should drink tea. There's like some cheekiness with that. But then you get in there, and then all of a sudden the reader gets beaten on the head with this very extreme metaphysical argument that there just is what there is, non-being is incoherent nonsense, and therefore we're all invincible and unchanging and eternal. And so I would like to think that readers have gone from this kind of innocent and cheeky discussion outside the temple about how they're not allowed to drink coffee and they should use British spelling and they should cover up and they not have tattoos or anything. And then they enter and suddenly it's like, oh, wait a minute. There's this guy kind of getting smacked in the face with a very, very brief but extreme metaphysical position. So I was always happy with the way the book, that maybe is the real beginning of the philosophy of the book, is that point. And I always thought that opening speech there was good, and it draws on a lot of ancient literature. I mean, there's a similarity to Archimedes there You know, Archimedes said, if I could stand on another planet, I could move this one with a lever. And the speaker in that room says something along the lines of, I don't have the book in front of me, but he says, you know, there's no place outside of being that I could stand and affect or impact being. You know, there's no other place I could stand upon which to impact this or to move this. But there's a lot of classical references or allusions in there. And so I thought that was really good. In terms of just the story, I was very happy. I'm not sure how it will be received. So I don't know if you ever went hiking at night in the book. So there's a hiking trail you can go to, and you can go in the afternoon. And whenever you go hiking, you generally encounter some mythological people in the book. And so if you go hiking at night, eventually you meet a person or a woman drawn from classical Chinese antiquity. But I think I would just be interested in how people receive that character. It's not hypersexualized, but she's kind of a very extreme character. Again, it is a mythological character from China. I didn't just weave her out of whole cloth, but I think maybe, I don't know if I went over the top or not, but I thought that was kind of a fun person to write as well. So story-wise, I think the nighttime hike, that was kind of a fun thing to write. I hope I didn't go over the top. And then in terms of philosophy, I liked that opening argument there when they first walk into the dark room.
And we are unfortunately getting close to time, but I'd like to ask you one more question, then Hazy could ask you one as well. But first off, I want to let you know you're more than welcome back on our podcast anytime you want. Just go ahead and hit us up.
Thank you.
Save your plans in the future. This has been an enjoyable conversation. But I'd like to ask you, what would you recommend for readers coming into this? What would you tell them? Like, hey, would you say drop all of your assumptions? Where you say, come in, you know, if your view sharpened, honed, and strong, and see how they hold up? How would you tell a reader to approach it?
Jeez. I would just tell them to have an open mind and not turn back if they find something disagreeable. Because at the end of the day, I hope they can enjoy the story and the experience of just visiting this location that I've described, talking with the people there, and at no point do they ever have to really agree with them. They can move on. They can always just go for a hike in the woods and look at some wildlife. And it's just like a little retreat. It's like, here is a book that you own. You don't have to give up your beliefs or get ready for a fist fight with me. It's just, here is a little retreat where you can clear your mind, think about philosophy, and just be a little open-minded and carefree and see if there's anything valuable in there. But the book is not trying to, you know, don't be worried about getting into a fight or any like vicious arguments or anything like that. It's really not. It's just a chance to have a nice, pleasant read without big words, without needing to know the history of all philosophy. Just get ready for like a nice casual read and some fun philosophy, and maybe you'll find something that really grabs you.
All right. Thank you very much. Hazy, do you have any closing comments?
Thank you for joining us again. It was really, really intense, actually. I really appreciate metaphysics as a concept and just get entranced by the conversations as they go on. And I think that the book is quite inviting. I think in terms of its writing, it entices the reader to be a part of the story before peeling back the lesson of whatever is being described. And I think that's a good way to write something. And plus, it just creates readability even if you don't exactly agree with necessarily what's being said. So I think I would implore other people to read it as well. That's everything for me.
Yeah, definitely that first 45 minutes of the podcast, I was pushing myself there. But...
I heard
tweet upon what are
in the background.
Oh, yeah. Wait, Afon, what are some social medias people can find you on, and where can they find your work?
Certainly, I could be found on Twitter, or X as they call it these days, at Tweetafon. My work, of course, Alea, is available on Amazon.com. I published it through them. It's amazing these days how people can now use Amazon and other platforms to easily get books out there in print and on ebook format. So I have both of them up there. I'm mostly just active on Twitter these days and sell the book through Amazon. I'm of course on forums like RPG Codex. And sometimes I may or may not be found as an anonymous on 4chan on literary side and history and humanities. But But yeah, that's, you'll find me on Twitter essentially, and I'm looking forward to more spaces with you, Solar. Thank you for the having me on as well. It was a pleasure. It was a great conversation. You too, Hazy. And I can tell you guys prepared. I like the questions you asked. You're asking the right questions, and maybe I didn't convince you with my answers. Maybe not. But but you're asking the right questions, and I appreciate how well you guys prepared.
Thank you, Tweetathon. And one more thing before you go. But who are some people online that have helped you out along this journey in regards to both close friends, you'd say, or people helped you with your book?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, there's, you mentioned a number of people who are active on Twitter, like Athenian Stranger. Alejandro, of course, as well. Alejandro actually was kind enough to read, the first 20, 30 pages of the book, and gave a lot of very helpful feedback on an early draft, and that led to a lot of changes and improvements. Obviously, the book itself is 300 and something pages, but yeah, he gave some very helpful advice on it. Maybe my arrival at Parmenides and my research and my writing is rather personal and maybe just my own. I wouldn't say anyone pushed me into Parmenides or I relied on a good friend having conversations with them to better understand Parmenides. I sort of arrived where I am via my own research, but also through discussions, well, with yourself as well, Sola, but many, many people on Twitter and on forums, but they were not in agreement with me. It was more like, they say steel sharpens steel, is that the phrase? It's like you have this amazing place. It's not an ancient agora, but it's a Twitter space or a forum thread, and there are people who are taking it seriously and will butt heads with you and make you sharper or make you stronger. And so I do have people who read parts of the text and advised me, like a Gray Matter and Alejandro, but also I have more generally, and I think more importantly, just everyone online that I interact with in these spaces, like the ones you host and others host, where it really is like steel sharpening steel, or at least I would never have even known some of the objections or things I need to clarify had I not had people around who disagree with me and are willing to discuss it with me, and whether it's arguing about lions and gazelles or the meaning of the universe. But yeah, it's amazing. It's like an ancient agora with all different viewpoints, and we all get together and we clash, and the result is this book and so much more. It's pretty amazing time to be alive.
Definitely. Always love interacting with people online, and I'm always glad to find people like you. And I consider you to be, well, a lot of those guys, I consider you guys to be a lot more than just intellectual sparring partners. But over time, I want to thank you, because I consider you overall to be a friend. And that's something that I hold and cherish deeply. So if you ever need anything, I got your back. Feel free to hit me up on anything.
Thank you, Sola. It's always a pleasure interacting with you. It's good to hear that.
All right. That has been all, folks, from this episode of Rec Room Radio. If you have any guests in particular in mind that you would like to be on our show, feel free to DM me at Sola Requiem. That is my Twitter handle. It is SOLA_Requiem, REQUIEM. Sorry, I probably spelled that wrong. I'll correct that after. But if you guys have any further questions at all before we close up shop.
No further questions from me, Sola. It was a pleasure being here. Thank you again.
All right. Thank you very much.
And you've seen us on HD. Yeah.